John Bassanio, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Houston, Texas, huge church, said a little old lady asked him one time, said, "Pastor John, when are you going to come visit me?" He said, "Ma'am, you don't want to be that ill." So, anyway, I walked in there and I talked to him for about 15 minutes. I read him some scripture. I had a word of prayer with him. And I walked out. But he didn't need me. It was a total waste. He didn't need me. 5 lay pastors had already been to see him in the last 24 hours. And I walked out of there and I started crying and tears started trickling down my cheeks. And I said, "That's it. That is it. That's the way God meant for the church to operate. God never meant for the church to be a one-man superstar show where the pastor personally cares for everybody's needs. But He meant for the body to care for itself, using our shape and our giftedness. 58 times in the New Testament, the phrase one another is used. Love one another, care for one another, exhort one another, help one another, greet one another, share with one another, admonish one another, counsel one another, on and on. It is the mutual ministry of the body to itself. And somehow we've gotten this idea that the pastor is supposed to do all the ministry. And of course, as pastors, we want to feel needed. We want to fly in like Superman with our cape into the whole hospital room. And you come in and sprinkle pixie dust all around the bed. You know? And in your hired holy man voice, it's, "Here a prayer, there a prayer, everywhere a prayer, prayer." You know? And we bless them and then we fly off into the sunset. And the people... And that's beautiful. And the people in the bed goes, "And who was that man?" And I never even got a chance to thank him. And of course, we're wearing our mask and we want to lift up our mask and say, "See, it's me, it's me." You know? And we want to pull back our chest and show the big S on our chest, which stands for stupid. It's a quick way to an early grave, try to meet everybody's need. There's no way you can personally meet everybody's need. God doesn't expect it, and you better stop it too. God says it's the body that cares for itself. Does that make sense? Revival happens when lay people are released for ministry. And that only happens when you trust people. And you let them make some of the mistakes. And you say, "Okay, you know, so what? You know, we start these small groups. Some of them go off into heresy. Every church needs a good heresy now and then. You know? Okay. I mean, what's the worst thing they can do? They leave the church. Well, let them go. Okay? Let them go. You try to hold on to everybody, you're guaranteeing no growth. Then number 9, provide the resources needed. The support, material support, communication support, promotional support, moral support. And then number 10, always keep the vision before them. Now, what I mean by that is that you recruit to a cause greater than yourself. You never ask people to serve in ministry as a favor to you. But you challenge them with a vision. I make no apology in saying this to people. In every membership class, I will look them straight in the eye and I'll say this. I make no apology in saying to you that maybe the most significant thing you do with your life is join this church, get involved in a ministry here, and help build the kingdom of God in this part of the world. I don't know a more significant thing to do with your life. If I knew a more significant thing to do with my life than give it in ministry and service to Jesus Christ, believe me, I'd be doing it because I decided a long time ago I'm not going to waste my life. But whatever you do for Jesus Christ and your church is going to far outlast anything else you do. It will outlast your career. it will outlast your hobbies, it will even outlast your own family. I said, can you imagine getting to heaven? And 75 years from today, somebody comes up to you and says, I want to thank you. And you say, I'm sorry, but I don't even know you. And you say, no, you don't know me. But you were one of the pioneers at Saddleback Church. And you prayed. And you shared. And you joined the membership of that church. And you got involved in ministry. And you sacrificed. And you helped build all those buildings. And you served. And you built programs. And you ministered. And 50 years after you died, that church reached me for Jesus Christ. And I'm in heaven because of you. Thank you. If you know a greater thing than the kingdom of God to give your life to, I challenge you to stand up right now and state it. There is no greater cause than God's kingdom and God's church. We're talking about impacting eternity. And every moment that I spend in ministry, I'm making an eternal difference. There is nothing else on earth that matters more. Nothing. Nothing. And so I don't apologize at all in saying, give 110% of your life to Jesus Christ and serving Him in the body of Christ, in His family. And sacrifice everything you've got because He sure did it for you. He stretched out His arms on the cross and said, I love you this much. There's nothing more important. And when you bring people into your church with that kind of commitment and that kind of challenge, that's the kind of challenge they tend to live up to. On the other hand, if you say, well, if you'd like to join us, go right ahead, you know, yes. Fill out a little card, here it is. People respond to the level of commitment you challenge them at. Now, the vision must be renewed. Do you remember the story of Nehemiah? He built the wall around Jerusalem in how many days? 56 days. And do you remember in Nehemiah chapter 4, it says halfway through the project, the people got discouraged. They lost their vision. Nehemiah didn't throw up his hand and say, oh, it wasn't a good idea, let's forget it, let's just all go home. No, he just recast the vision and reorganized the project halfway through. And they finished in 56 days. The Nehemiah principle is this. Vision must be renewed every 26 days. That's why we have SALT. That's why at least once a month I talk about the vision somehow in a message. Because people forget, we get distracted. Now we're going to take a break now, but let's pause for a moment of prayer. Would you bow your heads with me? Father, I want to thank you for your love for us, and I want to thank you for letting us not only be saved, but letting us serve you. Thank you for the privilege of ministry. Thank you that you have shaped every one of us uniquely, with spiritual gifts and heart and ability and personality and experiences. And this shape was not given by accident, and this shape was not given to waste, but it was given for a purpose. I pray that each of us here would not only build purpose-driven churches, but that we would begin to live purpose-driven lives based on your purpose and plan, your gifts that you've given to us. We know that one day we will stand before you and give an account of how we used our shape. We want to be able to hear you say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. So help us to make it count. In Jesus' name, amen. Go up there and help him with power. This last session together, I would like for us to talk about how do you lead a church through change. There are many, many things you must do in order to move your church from being a program-based church to being a purpose-driven church. And those changes often create conflict. So, In this session, I want to share with you a few suggestions on how to lead your church through change without losing your job. Or, subtitled, How to Not Perish in the Parish. Number one, first, before you do anything, you need to decide if the church should be changed. And there are some aspects that you should consider, and I'm very serious about this. First, in location. Is this church the right place, in the right place for growth? Is the church worth changing? Does it need to die and be reborn somewhere else? Now, let me say this. A church is a body, and just like bodies are born and they grow and they mature and they go through adolescence and they have effective years and then they taper off and then they eventually die. No church, individual congregation, is meant to last forever. None of the original seven churches of Revelation that we read in Revelation are still around. Ephesus, Thyatira, these kind of things. They're not here. And churches often have to die, and then out of their death are the seeds that are planted that other churches are reborn. Communities change and things happen. Is there a more receptive area? Could I be more effective somewhere else? What is the realistic potential, even if the church is renewed? Then you have to ask what I call the leadership questions. Am I the right person to lead this change? Is this the kind of church that I should be pastoring? In other words, do I match the congregation? Do I match the community? Before you do any changes, ask these questions. Is the existing leadership likely to support me in change? In other words, if they stay, can the church grow? And then you ask the longevity question, and that is, am I willing to give the rest of my life to this church? Now look up here. If you do not intend to stay in the church you are for a significant period of time, 10, 15, 20 years, or even the rest of your life, don't mess up someone else's church. Is that understandable? What happens, I don't know about Australia, but this happens all the time in America. Some hotshot pastor comes in who gets great ideas with great vision and great grandeur and comes in and mixes it all up and gets it all started and the mess starts happening. And before it's all worked out, he gets called to greener pastures. And he leaves. And he leaves the folks with a mess. And inevitably what happens is the pendulum swings from, yes, we're willing to do anything to reach the world, to, we're not changing anything. And the next three or four pastors have to pay for that guy's mistakes. And what happens is we move from, yes, we're open, to, no, we're not open to anything. We're not changing for nobody because nobody sticks around. So if you're not going to stay with the church, if you're not willing to prove that you love it, that you're willing to lay down your life for the church, don't attempt to lead it through change. There is no growth without change. And there is no change without loss. And there is no loss without pain. It is painful to grow. Ask any teenager. Because when you grow, certain parts of your body, they hurt and they ache. And you sometimes feel uncoordinated. And you don't feel like you're all balanced. So, you decide if the church should be changed and if you should be involved. And number two, make a public commitment to stay. One of the laws of leadership is that change takes time. You know, I once read that the average pastor leaves a church because of seven people. Seven people. What does it take you to get discouraged? You know, I've discovered that when the pastor leaves, problems stay. But when the pastor stays, problems leave. Usually in a church, you can do nothing wrong for the first 2 years. You can do nothing right for the next 2 years. And then along about year 6 or 7, you start building some credibility and things can get going. So you need to be willing to stay. Now, I heard of a church that said, we're looking for a pastor who's willing to stay. And one guy said, oh, I'm your man. He said, I stayed with both of my churches until they died. So we don't want that kind of change. You know it takes 14 miles to get a oil tanker to make a U-turn? And in a church, it's the same thing. Churches are like oil tankers. They're giant ships. Minor change is major victory. Would you agree with that? Do you know we came over on a Qantas 747? Did you know that a 747 can make a 90-degree turn? But the passengers don't like it. Now, whoa, I feel it. You can lead a church to change very rapidly, but people won't like it. They get a little change sick. They get a little seasick. In fact, there are only three times that you can lead change rapidly. Number one is during the honeymoon, when you first arrive as a leader in the church. Now, let me say, there's no such thing as a honeymoon, really. It's only suspended judgment. They're just checking you out to see if you have credibility or not. And if you are a new pastor coming in, I would say grab the bull by the horns and go for it. A lot of people say, oh no, wait for a year or two and then start making changes. I could not disagree more. There are some things that can only be done in the first 90 days, or it'll take you 10 years to get them done. And you seize the iron while it's hot, and you go for it. They're ready to make some changes. Your new leadership. Did you know that during the Reagan presidency in the United States, he was president for 8 years, and in that Reagan revolution where he basically reinvented American government during his 8 years there, every one of the changes that Ronald Reagan introduced were introduced in the first 100 days of his presidency, and he spent the next years, 8 years, just working out the implications. But they were all introduced within the first 100 days. We knew where he was going. You may not agree with him, but you knew where he was going. Then, a couple years ago, in 1996, I guess it was, one of his disciples became Speaker of the House in the United States, a man named Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich was a Reagan disciple. And he came up with a thing called Contract with America. Some of us thought it was Contract on America. But the Contract with America really was a bunch of good ideas that he said, we're going to do these in the first 100 days. And sure enough, that's what he did. Why? Because there's some things you can only do right up front. And if I were going to a church, I would sit down with him first and say, now before we get married here, this is what I'm going to do if I come as pastor. And I would spell it out, and I'd ask for a week of conferences, a week of Bible conference. Monday night I'd talk about worship. Here's what we're going to do with worship. Tuesday night I'd talk about evangelism. Here's what we're going to do in evangelism. Wednesday night I'd talk about fellowship. Here's what we're going to do in fellowship, what I believe. Folks, if you want me, you get the whole package. I'm not saying I'm the only way. I'm not the only way. There are lots of ways, but this is what God has called me to do. And if you get me, you get the package. If you don't want the package, let's just don't get married. Does that make sense? And you get people to sign on the dotted line, actually sign a contract. Things like, we will do whatever it takes to reach this community for Christ. And then a year down the line, when you start saying, you know, we need to push out this wall, or we need to add this, add another service. And people say, oh, we can't do that. And you say, wait a minute, we signed this. We will do whatever it takes to reach this community for Christ. Kind of like a prenuptial agreement, you know. You just spell it out up front. Otherwise, don't make the commitment. So, in the first days. The second time you can lead rapidly is in a crisis. If a church is desperate, that's a good church to lead. Desperate churches are easy to lead because they're either going to grow or they're going to close. So when a church is in a crisis, a desperate church is a good church to go as a pastor to because they're easy to lead. The only other time you could lead rapidly is after you have created a climate for change. Now, that's what we've seen at Saddleback. For 17 years, we've gone through one change after another. We've gone through so many changes that nobody even feels it anymore. We add services, drop services, change locations. You know, we mentioned earlier, in the first 15 years of the church, we used 79 different buildings for different services. We might have Sunday morning one place, Sunday night another place, midweek another place, Bible study another place, 79 different locations for different programs. Now, we only wanted really intelligent people, so we kept changing the location. We said, you know, if you can figure out where we are tonight, you get to come. Now, we've gone through so many changes that now people just put up with it. We're used to it. And so there is never any resistance to any change we make because we've been in constant change for 17 years. Now, once you've done that, number three, begin sharing the vision. You want to have a biblical basis for everything. Lead them in a study of the biblical basis of the church, as we talked about. Condense your strategy into an acrostic. Saddleback is built on 10 simple principles. And if you look on, what is it, page 2 of your program, you'll see that what we did is we took the 10 principles and put them into our name. Seeker-sensitive services. A stands for affinity group, driven by purpose. D, second D, is defined target. I would suggest you take your name and create a West Side strategy or a Gateway strategy or a, you know, New Life Center strategy and be able to spell out for your people. In the membership class, we cover this strategy. S stands for simple seeker services. A stands for affinity groups, having small groups. And we explain our strategy. In the five-day conference, we used to take an hour and a half on each of these letters to explain in detail why we do what we do. Create discontent with the status quo. Appeal to the best in people. Build morale. We can do this for God's glory. And create a sense of destiny. Number four, expose your key leaders to model churches. I have to say we corrected this. The last time we were in Brisbane, I said, expose your key leaders to models. And a woman came up and said, I'm not exposing my husband to anybody. key model churches. I love to be around models, model churches, that is. Because I always learn from it. As I said, I always say, amen, brother, teach me how you're doing it too. You can learn from anybody if you know the right questions. And so you always learn fastest by model. We learn to read, we learn to write, we learn to do arithmetic. Everything we learn fastest by modeling. The same is true in growth. And when you want to teach your people how to grow, when you want to teach your people how to lead your church to grow, you do it by showing them models. You take them to growing churches. You bring them to seminars like this. You hand them tapes of seminars like this or books. And you say, here, read this. Think about this. You see, this is how we taught you. I didn't just get up here and said, this is how you need to do it. I said, here's one way of doing it. Here's a model. And you go, oh, I see how you do that. You have a class on Sunday afternoon and it's 4 from 8 and it's called 101. And I gave you a model. Now, if you go back home and you start talking to people, say, this is how we're going to do it, but you don't give them a model, it won't work. Now, when I started Saddleback, before I did, I wrote to the 100 largest churches in the United States, personally, and got back a series of questions that I, answers to questions I had sent them, collected all, I learned from all these different churches. Remember, God has not called us to be unique. He's called us to be effective. And I learned a long time ago that I don't have to make everything up for it to work. Now, look at this verse. 1 Thessalonians 1. Read it with me. You became imitators of us, and so you became a model to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. Now, notice, Paul says here, to imitate something that works is not bad. In fact, it's biblical. The Thessalonians did. Paul says, you imitated our ministry, and then you became a model for other believers. You know what? Saddleback is not a perfect model. I'm more aware of that than you are. If you want to know the weaknesses, I'm very aware of them and I can share them with you. But we are a model. You don't have to be perfect to be a model. And you can learn from models of all sizes, shapes, colors, nations. It doesn't matter. You learn from everybody. Now, I want to warn you that if you go back from this seminar and you start making some kind of changes, there will be people say, oh, you know, you're just trying to copy that American church. You're just trying to be that Saddleback. You're just stealing it from them. You know what? You say, so what? They stole it from everybody else. Because we did. We have learned from all kinds of churches. The last time I was in Australia, I bought 5 books on Australian churches and read them going back and implemented the things I learned on the way going back. Why? Because I'm not proud. I just want to be effective. Okay? Whatever works is what I'm going to use. And so, my prayer is that you will learn from Saddleback's model and that you will become a model. Honestly, Saddleback is so big that we're not a very good model for most churches unless you happen to be a really big thinker. I mean, when you think about a church with 13,000, that's kind of up there in the stratosphere. What we really need is churches. We need purpose-driven churches of all sizes and shapes who are models for all sizes and shapes of other churches. Does that make sense? Since the book, The Purpose-Driven Church, came out, we have been overloaded at Saddleback with requests for examples of other churches besides Saddleback. Well, there are now about 6,000 or 7,000 of them, of 63 different denominations. But the word is getting out. In fact, our receptionists were kind of overloaded. We couldn't figure out why they could never get their work done. So we did an audit, and we found out that in the last, for nearly 6 months, we have been getting over 4,000 phone calls a day at our church office. And most of them from pastors and church leaders around the world. And they're all saying, you know, can you tell me a purpose-driven Methodist church of about 300? You know, because we're at 200 and we need that. Or can you tell me a purpose-driven Anglican church of 150? Or can you tell, and you know what we need? We need purpose-driven churches of 75 who are models for purpose-driven churches of 25. And we need purpose-driven churches of 125 who can model for churches of 85 people. And we need purpose-driven churches of 200 and 300 who can model for churches of 100. And we need purpose-driven churches of 800 to model for churches that are 300. You know, if you were to go into one of these computer superstores out here, and you were to look on the shelf, they have all these computers. They have different names on them. IBM, Micron, AST, Compaq, Dell, all these different versions of computers. They are all different sizes and shapes. They all have different bells and whistles on them. But inside every single one of those computers is a little processor. It's called the Intel chip. And it's in every one of them. And it's the process that makes the thing work. Now, I say to you, without embarrassment, that I personally believe that the purpose-driven process, the baseball diamond, is the Intel chip of the 21st century for the church. It's simply a model that says, I don't care what your denominational label is. I don't care what size your church is. I don't care what country it's in. I don't care what your doctrinal distinctives are. I don't care what your worship style is. I want to know, do you have a process that balances the 5 things God has called the church to do? Worship, evangelism, fellowship, ministry, and edification. Do you have a strategy and a structure that forces you to balance those purposes so it produces help, and that help produces growth? And honestly, we need some of you to be models. So we could say, yeah, let me tell you about a church in Ipswich that's running 200 that you can model after. And if you'll let us know what you're doing, we will pass it on, believe me. Now, it's a mistake to just go home and try to implement all these things simply by telling people. You have to insert them into your church slowly. Give them books. Give them tapes. Let the people come up with ideas. You're going to give them a tape. Listen to this. Think it'll work? Oh, no, I don't think it'll ever work, but you think it. You know, you try it. And you listen to them. Then number 5, build on your strengths, not your weaknesses. Build on, you know, every church has strengths and every church has weaknesses. I want to tell you something. You are already doing some things right. You're already doing a lot of good things. I'm sure of that. What you need to do is take the things that you're already doing good and tweak them. Turn up the heat. Just do them better. Just try to do it better than you were before. You're already doing it good. Just do it better. You know, what happens is many churches run to their weaknesses. They go to a conference and they say, oh, this church uses drama. And they go, well, we got to use drama. Well, nobody's dramatic in your church, but we got to have it. You know? No, you don't. You know, in American football, if your weak left side is weak, you don't run the plays to the left side. You run them to the right side, where your team is strongest. And that's true. Don't focus on your weaknesses. Don't focus on your church's problems. Focus on your dreams. I'll tell you why. You're always going to have problems. It's not, well, when we get all our problems solved, then we'll grow. No, growth is going to create some new problems. And so you focus on your dreams. The church that focuses on its past is already a has-been church. Number six, be strategic in introducing change. Be strategic in introducing change. And notice here, choose your battles carefully, strategically. In other words, don't fight unnecessary battles. Patton used to say, never fight a battle where you don't gain anything by winning. You don't get caught up in side issues. Focus on the most important and the easiest things to change. What's the most difficult thing to change in your church? Number one, your music. What's the second most difficult thing to change in your church? Your name. What's the easiest thing to change in your church, Pastor? Your preaching. Man, we didn't cover that in this seminar. I wish we had on. I have some lectures on communicating to change lives. If you're a teacher, a preacher, I would encourage you to get those. And when I started Saddleback, I had been involved in evangelism already for about 10 years. And I had preached in over 120 crusades. And I went back, I had about 10 years of sermons stockpiled. I could have just floated, you know, coasted for several years preaching old sermons out of the barrel. But when I got serious about reaching hardcore pagans, the unchurched who couldn't care less about Jesus, I went through all of those 10 years of messages and I said, would this message make sense to a non-believer who has no religious background at all? And I threw out every message I had preached in 10 years except two. And I started over. And I developed a series of eight questions that I asked myself that helped me stay on track to develop seeker-sensitive messages that are strong on the content, but share it in a way that people understand. Focus on the easiest things to do. You know, only two out of every 10 plays win a ball game. The secret of great coaching is knowing what two plays those are. And the quickest way to discourage your church is to go home with a list of 30 things you're going to change. Just pick one thing and start with that. And then pick another thing and go with that. And keep it simple and change what you can and compromise on the non-essentials. Be a proponent of the new, not an opponent of the old. You know, in New Orleans, the city, the homes are built up on stilts. They have these poles that they build the homes up on because New Orleans, the city of New Orleans is built on the Mississippi River at the mouth of it. And it floods every year. And so the houses won't get flooded. They build them up on these poles. Well, about every 3 or 4 years, the stilts go rotten. Now, they don't come in and just knock out all the stilts. What they do is they come in and they build up new, stronger supports underneath the house. And they let the old ones just crumble away. The wrong thing to do is to go home and say, well, we're going to knock out all the old, and you just clear the slate, clean it out, and the house collapses. No, what you do is you go in and you just start adding some new things, adding the new things, a proponent of the new, and let the old fall away by neglecting it. You will succeed in what you emphasize. That's very important. The next step, respect and enlist support from legitimizers in your church. Who are the legitimizers? They are the E.F. Huttons. They are the people that when they speak, everybody listens. The legitimizers in your church are the people that when you have a church business meeting, they're usually not elected. They sit toward the back. And when you say, now, what do you think we ought to do about this? When you get ready to take a vote, everybody looks back to see what John thinks. And if John goes, everybody goes, and if John goes, everybody goes, no. Now, you need to know who those people are, and you need to get them on board. Hopefully you brought them with you today. Okay? They're the legitimizers in your church. And they're the people who, that when they speak, they have the credibility and other people listen. Look, if you got a box here, and you divide this box in quarters, and you've got in your church, pastor, there are people who are older than you and people who are younger than you. There are people who came before you and there are people who've come since you've been there. Who are the most easy people, the easiest group to lead? Those who are younger and came after you, right? The most difficult group to lead are those who are older and came before. And the other two groups are always watching these two groups to see who they're going to follow. What you need is you need an Aaron, a spokesperson in every one of those boxes who speak for you. John Maxwell said that when he was at Hamhill, Indiana, little tiny country church, he said there was a farmer named Claude. And every time he had a major change he wanted to make in the church, he'd go talk to Claude. He'd go get up on Claude's tractor as he's going along and said, "You know, Claude, we really need to pave the parking lot. It looks like the pits. And we got to get this thing looking nice to reach the unchurched." Claude would say, "Don't worry, pastor. We'll get it taken care of." Claude would make sure it got done. Then he'd go back and say, "You know, Claude, the church really needs painting. We need to spruce it up. It looks pretty ugly. It hadn't had any paint on it for 10 years. Let's get this thing painted." Claude would say, "Don't worry, pastor. We'll get it taken care of." He said, "You know, one time I went to him and he said, 'Pastor Claude, we need to bust out this wall over here to build some more Bible study classrooms for our children.'" Claude said, "Don't worry, pastor. We'll get it taken care of." He said, "You know, I built that church on God and Claude." Now, you better know who the Claudes are in your church. Let me ask you. I want to ask those of you who are senior pastors, who brought key lay leaders with you today, would you raise your hand and keep your hands raised? Your senior pastor, you brought key. Okay, look around at these men. These are the geniuses in our midst. Okay? All right. Do you realize how further along the road they are than you are? Because you go back to your church and say, "You know, well, I got to tell you this and tell you this." Now they're going back with a team who have caught the vision, understand, yes, this is what God's called us to do. And there are people who can help interpret the dream, interpret the vision. Very important. They also call every change an experiment. This removes the fear of failure. You know, when we first started Saturday night services, we were one of the first churches. We just ran out of space on Sunday. So we said, "We're going to have to start another service." And I got up and said, "Folks, we're going to start a Saturday night service. It's an experiment. We're not going to do it from here to the millennium. We're going to do it for 3 months or 4 months. I don't even remember what it was. I said, "I need about 300 of you to move to Saturday night. We'll just do it for 3 months. It's an experiment. If it doesn't work, I will be the first person to do it." You see what I just did? I removed all the fear of failure. It's just an experiment. We have done more things at Saddleback Church that didn't work than did. We're just not afraid to fail. Someday I'm going to write a book, 1,000 Ways to Not Grow a Church. Put them all in there. And the things we learned the hard way save you from... Oh, don't try that one. Numbers, the other there, know how many credits a change will cost and know how many credits you have to spend. Now, let me explain this. A credit is an amount of trust that people put in your leadership. And you always must make sure you have enough trust equal to the change that you're asking to make. If it's a little change, you only need a little trust. If it's a big change, people have to have a lot of trust in your credibility. Now, there are three things, leader, that build trust, that build credit, that you can use to exchange for major changes in your church. The three things that build trust are, number one, compassion. When you prove that you love people, that builds trust. When you're there for their crisis, when their child has run away, when somebody's at the deathbed, when you're there in the marriage difficulty, and you show genuine love, and you lay down your life for your sheep, people build trust in you. Compassion. Number two, competence. Past successes prove that you know what you're doing, so people trust you. Successes are money in the bank, and failures are debts. The number three, consistency builds trust. when you are reliable, when people know that you aren't fickle, when they you know that the direction you are headed, and you keep going, and you don't keep changing directions and changing horses in the middle of strength. Now, you always have to have enough credits to do the change. Do any of you guys have a wallet? You got a wallet? There you go. Thank you. All right. Thank you, everybody. Go on home now. Thank you very much. God bless you. If you are a pastor, you go into a church, a new church, with a certain number of credits in your wallet that you may exchange for major changes. If you have been in ministry, say, for 10 years or so, 15 years, and you've had a good ministry, you haven't set the world on fire, but you're a solid man of God, you kept your pants on, you've been morally pure, you know. Can I say that in Australia? Yeah. You know, and you've just been a good, solid Bible teacher. You go in with a good number of credits, which you can use. If you are coming from a larger church to a smaller church, you have an extra number of credits in your wallet because you have proven competent that you can lead a church to that size growth. If you are a brand new pastor, you've only been ministering for a year or two or two, 3 years, you only have a few credits in your wallet. If you are a theological college student, you have no credits. Okay, none. Now, it's obvious you're a theological college student. Okay. Let's take up an offering for this gent. All right, there it is. Now, Jack Hiles, who at one time had the largest Sunday school in North America, First Baptist Church of Hammond, Indiana, he had a number of credits in his wallet. And one day they were going to tear down a building to build a whole new church building. It was a Sunday school building. And he had told the people that they were going to do it. So they said, fine. Well, on the day that the wrecking crew arrived to tear down the building, he was on the telephone. And when they came, he said, yeah, you can start on it. Go ahead. It's out there. And as he was on the phone, he got this sinking feeling just as he looked up out the window to receive the wrecking ball destroying the wrong building. Now, he got up on midweek prayer service and he said, oops, sorry, they let that guy stay. Why? He had a lot of credits. But I guarantee you, he probably did a lot of hospital visits before he suggested another major change. Because he lost a lot of them that day. All right, let's thank this guy for having enough faith in me here. So, all right. Number 7. As you lead a church through change, don't take criticism personally. As your church begins to grow, you're going to face many criticisms because growth means restructuring, and every time you restructure, you disappoint people. And I want to tell you something. The older I get, the harder that gets to do. You don't like to disappoint people. But there will be 3 common criticisms you can count on as your church begins to grow. Number 1 is the care issue, and the care issue goes like this. Somebody will come and say, Pastor, you just don't care about me anymore. Now, what they mean is, Pastor, you are not available to me like you used to be when the church was small. And they're right. They are right. Because the fact is, the bigger the church gets, you cannot be available all the time to everybody. Do you know that I still have 60 people who are members at Saddleback, who joined in the first 2 years of the church? Can you imagine the culture shock they've been through in the last 17 years? In those early years, they used to say, hey, Rick, you want to come over for dinner? I said, why not? Nothing else to do. And I was in everybody's home practically every week. Today, with as many people we have in our church, I'm lucky to see those original members, even see them once a month, much less shake hands with them or have a meaningful conversation with them. It takes very unselfish, very mature people to share a pastor like that. To be willing to give up their pastor and the relationship like that, to give up their spot, to change locations, how many number of times that we did, to park 3 miles away on Christmas and or Easter and ride a bus so that all the visitors can have a parking spot, to go through tent where we lived in a tent for 3 years or 2 years where we burned up in the summer and we got rained on in the winter and the winds blew, icy winds through in the fall. And I've seen them stand up and give their chair to a visitor and even take their coat and put it around a visitor who didn't know that we didn't have, you know, walls in those days. Unselfish people. That's what it takes. Now, the care issue. You don't care about me anymore. He's right. They're right when they say that. But the answer is not for you to try to meet their needs. The answer is small groups. You must learn to teach. People must learn to get their personal needs met, their pastoral care needs met, in a small group rather than from a senior pastor. And if they learn to use small groups for that, your growth can be sustainable. Then comes the second criticism. And the second criticism is the control issue. The control issue goes like this. As your church begins to grow, some of your people will say, you know, pastor, I'm just not in control anymore. Oh, nobody's going to say it like that. They won't be that blatant. What they will say is, pastor, I just don't feel involved like I used to feel. What they mean is, I'm no longer the big fish in the little pond because the pond got bigger. And as the church grows, the power gets diffused. The power gets shared. And some people who want to hold on to power can't handle that. I had a guy come to me one time and said, Pastor Rick, I'm leaving the church. I said, why? He said, because I want to be chairman of the board, and this church doesn't have a board. I said, bye. And he left. And he went and found a little church where he could be a big fish in a little pond, have a big title and control and pull all the strings and be a big shot. And that's where he needed to be. Now, growth always upsets the balance of power between the newcomers and the old-timers. Look up here. There's this scale. And when you start growing, you have all these old-timers. I'm not talking about age. I'm just talking about people who've been there a long time. And as you begin to add new people, the balance begins to shift. Now, when everybody wants the church to grow to a point. When your church first starts growing, all the old-timers go, isn't this great? Look at all these young couples coming in. They can help pay the bills. But all of a sudden, the day that happens when there are more newcomers than there are old-timers, whose church is it? And what happens the day somebody sits in my chair that I've sat in for the last 32 years? And what happens when all of a sudden you add a service? You say, if we add a service, I won't know everybody anymore. The very reason they resist the service is the very reason you need to add it. If you have to think you have to know everybody in your church, it will never grow beyond 300 people. The average person knows 67 people in a church, whether it's 60, 600, or 6,000. You don't have to know everybody in the church to feel like it's your church, but you do have to know somebody. And that happens through small groups. Now, the control issue is one that you cannot resolve by saying, okay, I'll give you back control. I've had people who I led to Christ, and I baptized them. And I walked them through the crisis of life. And I did their marriage. And I dedicated their babies. And then all of a sudden, one day, they started listening to some radio preacher and decided that the church should not be purpose-driven, but should go in this direction. And they come and they say things like, you know, if you don't change the church this way, we're going to leave. Now, that's called blackmail. And we ought to call it what it is. It's sin. It's wrong. And if God has called you to build a church on the five purposes of the church, you cannot surrender the leadership of your church to whiners. Some of you, that's all you needed to hear. Go home. Okay, that's all you need. If you wait until everybody gets on board your ship, it's never going to leave the harbor. And if you have to please everybody, your church will never grow. And if you expect unanimity in every decision, you must think you're in heaven, not on earth. You know, to dwell above with those we love, oh, that will be a glory. To dwell below with those we know, well, that's another story. You cannot give back control to small people. Then there's a third issue, and that's called the comfort issue. And the comfort issue is that you cannot grow without change. As I've already talked about this. Most people want the church to grow, but not at the expense of personal comfort. Oh, yeah, I want the church to grow, but not if we have to add another service. Yeah, I want the church to grow, but not if we have to relocate. Yeah, I want the church to grow, but not if it means changing the worship style. Sometimes you must be willing to let people leave the church. That's number 8. Be willing to let people leave the church. Now, I said earlier, the fact is people are going to leave your church no matter what you do. But when you define the vision, you're choosing who's going to leave. You say, but Rick, they're the pillars of the church. Yeah, you know what pillars are. They're the people that hold things up. How many Israelites did God have to kill in the desert before he let them go into the promised land? All of them. An entire generation, except for Caleb and Joshua. And the truth is, you may have to have some blessed subtractions from your membership before you start having significant additions. They're good people, but they're selfish. And they're not willing to have the church grow if it means their discomfort. And you must face it for what it is, and in the name of the kingdom of God, saying, I'm not going to let one person halt the growth of God's kingdom. Because people matter to the Lord. People are going to hell. Now you need to realize what I'm talking about here sounds so easy and so flippant, but it's the most difficult thing to do in ministry, to let people leave the church. Because I've had people that I've ministered to, and as they're walking out the door, every bone in my body wants to say, come back, come back, we'll change it. But if we do that, I violate the vision that God has called us to fulfill. Now you need to realize, about 80% of the people in your church are never going to change. So what do? You love everybody. You pray for everybody. You care for everybody. You treat everybody as a first-class citizen. You don't treat anybody with less respect. You minister to everybody. You show compassion to everybody. But you move with the movers. And in every church, there is a group that catches God's vision. And they realize the church doesn't exist for itself. We exist to reach our community. And it may be one couple or two couples or a group of singles or some young 20-something men and women in their 20s. But there's a group of maybe 5, 10, 15, or maybe even 20 people who catch the vision. You love everybody, but you move with the movers. Jesus did this. Jesus invested the maximum amount of time with those who would bear the maximum responsibility. Jesus loved the whole world. And he fed the thousands, fed the multitudes. But he trained the 70. And even within the 70, he discipled 12. And even in the 12, he mentored 3. He had an inner circle of Peter, James, and John. Only Peter, James, and John got to go into the Mount of Transfiguration. Only Peter, James, and John got to go into the Garden of Gethsemane. Only Peter, James, and John got to see Peter's mother-in-law, be healed. Was Jesus playing favorites? Absolutely. Absolutely. And did it pay off? Yes, it did. Because later in the book of Galatians, Paul says, Peter, James, and John, it's a different James, Peter, James, and John are the pillars of the church. It worked. It worked. So you love everybody, but you don't expect everybody to come along the ride. You move with the movers. Number 9, you continually remind people why you're making up these changes. You're doing it because people need the Lord. That's why we do this. Because people need the Lord. And number 10, affirm and appreciate people for the changes they do agree to make. Affirm and appreciate for the changes for the changes they do make. In other words, be grateful for minor changes. What I want to challenge you to do is focus on progress, not perfection. You will never have a perfect church. Saddleback is not a perfect church. It is a very, very imperfect church. So is yours. Every church, because it's made of sinners. If you ever find a perfect church, don't join it, because once you join it, it won't be perfect anymore. Now, be grateful for those minor changes. You have to live between the ideal and the real. Now, before we go to our workshops, let me conclude this part of the conference by talking to us specifically to two groups. One, some of you, having taught this now to over 40,000 pastors and leaders, I know that some of you are discouraged. Some of you say, you know, Rick, I just wish I had known this 20 years ago. And for some of you, this is kind of like trying to drink water from a fire hydrant. And it's just all overwhelming. Some people, you give them 100 new ideas and they can't do any. Here's what you do. Wow, something, I keep hitting that back here. Would you write this verse down? Proverbs 17:24. An intelligent man aims at wise action, but a fool starts off in many directions. What I suggest you do is go home from this conference and make a list of 10, 15, 20 things, ideas you've had, some of the things I've shared. Make a list of things to do, and then pick one thing. Don't try to do it all at once. Pick one thing. Get that done. Then pick another. We cannot do everything at once, but that doesn't stop us from doing something at once. Go home and do something immediately. It may be a commitment to simply learn. Look up here. Learn. Don't stop learning. Once a year, the pastors of the largest churches in America, the largest Baptist churches, get together and we go to a hotel for 2-3 days and just talk about growth. The 25 or 30 pastors of the largest churches. A number of years ago, I was at one of those meetings in Dallas. And I was a young man, and everybody in the room was almost twice my age. Adrian Rogers said, Rick, why don't you talk to us about Saddleback for a couple hours? Well, I was kind of in awe of all that, but I began talking to these men that I'd looked up to all my life. Sitting right catty-corner to me on the table was Dr. W.A. Criswell. W.A. Criswell was in his 80s. He's still alive. He is, without a doubt, the most influential Baptist pastor and the most influential American pastor in this last century. He built the largest church in the world at that time, the First Baptist Church of Dallas, Texas. Had 20,000 members. Criswell pastored that church for 50 years. One church. He wrote 56 books and influenced an entire generation of pastors. He's a genius. He reads the Bible. When he stands up to preach, he reads the Bible from the original Greek, just reading it, and translates as it goes. He has forgotten more than I will ever know. Now, I'm sitting here, this young whippersnapper, and Dr. W.A. Criswell has nothing to prove in his 80s, sits there and for 2 hours takes notes on me. Ideas. And I walked out of that room and the tears began to come down from my eyes because I was so humbled by that experience. I was so moved by that. And I said, God, when I'm in my 80s, may I be that teachable. And I thought, it's no wonder the guy was a spiritual giant. He never stops learning. That may be your first commitment. Others of you, you're discouraged. And I want to say to you, it's not how you start the ball game, but how you finish. It's not how you start the race. In any marathon race, oh, there's a huge crowd at the starting line.
but it thins out. It's how you finish. It doesn't matter where you've been. What matters is the direction of your feet. And I want to challenge you to make the rest of your life and the rest of your ministry the best of your ministry. You know some things after today. And you know where you need to go and what you need to learn. Because the tools that work in the 20th century are not going to work in the 21st. So we got to retool or sit on the shelf. And that's not God's will. God's will is that you stand before Him one day and He looks down and says, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. You were faithful in many things, in few things. Now be faithful in many. Come and celebrate your master's happiness." That's what I'm living for, an audience of one. And that's what you need to live for, an audience of one. That will help you when the criticisms come. They will come. It is not by accident that the most blessed ministries in the world are also the most criticized. If you call the shots, you're going to take the shots. And if you're going to be a pioneer in Australia, you're going to take the arrows in your back. Count on it.